So I'm here to preach to you today about lepton asymmetries, large lepton asymmetries. Here's a plan of what I'm going to do. I'm going to begin with some basic background materials just to set the scene, and then I'll move straight on to the subject of large lepton asymmetries. I'm going to give you a brief outline of some of the known asymmetry production mechanisms, existing constraints on asymmetries from things like from BBN and CMBR, and also other situations in which a large lepton asymmetry could actually be important. The second half of the talk will be focused on the effects of flavor oscillations on the asymmetries. And in particular, I'm going to discuss an equilibration and a mechanism through which the asymmetries in all three neutrino flavors can be equilibrated prior to the onset of BBN, and therefore the some of the new constraints that we're able to derive for the asymmetries because of this equilibration mechanism. So to start off with, here's a timeline showing you where we are in this talk in relation to all the major events which are thought to have taken place in the early history of time. We're interested in the epoch that begins shortly after the QCD phase transition and ends just before the onset of BBN. The temperature of the universe in this period is roughly between 1 and 100 MeV. So the standard view of the universe at this time is that it's radiation dominated, and the relativistic particle species that make up the primordial plasma are the electron, three families of left-handed neutrinos, and of course the photon. These particles are kept in kinetic equilibrium by interactions such as neutrino electron scattering and electron photon scattering, such that the distributions in phase space assume either the Fermi-Dirac or the Bose-Einstein form. The quantity mu here is the chemical potential. And when chemical equilibrium for an interaction is in place, chemical equilibrium implies that the sums of the chemical potentials on both sides of the arrow of the interaction must be equal. So from a process like neutrino-antineutrino annihilation into an electron, a positron, and then into photons, we can easily establish that the chemical potentials for a particle species and for its antiparticle have to be equal in magnitude but opposite in sign. A particle decouples from the plasma when the expansion rate, when its interaction rate drops below the expansion rate of the universe. And for the neutrino, this happens at a temperature of about 1 MeV. Now, there are many good reasons to believe that the neutrino masses are of the order of 1 EV or less, which means that the neutrinos decouple from the plasma when they're still relativistic. So consequently, their number density remains significant to these days to make up a relic neutrino background. And if the neutrinos happen to have the right masses, they can even be a significant source of dark matter. And there's, of course, also the decoupling of matter and photon that happens at a temperature of about 1 EV. And that's, of course, is the origin of the cosmic microwave background. The main issue we're concerned with here is the chemical potentials. And as I'll show you a little later, chemical potentials are generally associated with conserved charges. The universe has a net lepton baryon number. And from the measurements of light element abundances and from CMBR, we know that the baryon to photon ratio is roughly of the order 10 to minus 10. If the universe has a baryon number, it probably has a lepton number too. Whoops. I should only just show this one, but anyway, got both. A lepton number residing in the charged leptons is at most of the order of the baryon number because the universe is apparently electrically neutral. The same argument does not apply if the lepton numbers, if there are lepton numbers in the neutrino sectors. And since no one has actually seen a real neutrino, these numbers can still be quite large. They're free parameters and they can be quite large. The standard practice, of course, is to set these neutrino lepton numbers to the order of the baryon number. This comes from the general theoretical argument that B minus L should be conserved. But be aware that there are mechanisms which could generate large Ls and at the same time keeping the baryon number of the universe small. So at the end of the day, these three lepton numbers here are free parameters that remain to be constrained or determined from observations. So what we want to do now is to look at the possibility and the implications of large lepton numbers in more detail. Firstly, I'm going to just define some terms. The lepton number carried by an alpha-flavored neutrino is defined to be the asymmetry between the number densities in nu alpha and nu alpha bar, normalized to the photon number density. When kinetic and chemical equilibrium are in place, this number is simply related to the degeneracy parameter for the neutrino species. And the neutrino parameter, the degeneracy parameter, is really just a fancy term for the ratio of the chemical potential to the temperature of the species. So be forewarned that throughout this talk, I'll be using these four terms in the box interchangeably, although, strictly speaking, these last two terms are only equivalent to the first two when equilibrium is in place. There's several ways in which a large lepton asymmetries can be generated. But before I go through them, it's useful to understand why it is that people would rather buy a small lepton asymmetry scenario. First one is that B minus L is conserved in many grand unified theories. For example, in SG5, B minus L is zero. And secondly, if a large lepton asymmetry is generated before the electroweak phase transition by some unspecified mechanism, the electroweak spirons would always reprocess roughly half of this lepton asymmetry into a baryon asymmetry, which again forces the lepton asymmetry to be small. So naturally, scenarios that simultaneously allow for large L and small b would fall into two categories. In the first case, you simply have your lepton number generated after electroweak phase transition, and it turns out that you can do it via active sterile neutrino oscillations. Apart from the fact that you need to invent some light sterile neutrinos first, this mechanism requires only that there is a small baryon asymmetry in the cosmic plasma so as to give you a CPA symmetric background. The CPA asymmetric background would affect the neutrino and antineutrino oscillation rates differently, and an asymmetry just basically builds up from there through feedback effects. We know that an asymmetry of the order 10 to minus 1 can be generated in this fashion. A second class of mechanism involves ephlogdyne leptogenesis in the context of Susi gut. And there are two scenarios that I know of that fall under this heading. And the first one is to have this extremely large lepton number generated at some really high temperatures, something of your 10 to minus 2 to 1. This lepton number is so large that it actually stops the electroweak symmetry from being restored. And consequently, the spheron transitions are suppressed, and so your large lepton number is allowed to stay while you still have a small baryon number. An alternative scenario is to have these large lepton numbers absorbed by a class of non-topological solitons for cue balls, and consequently protected from the spherons if these cue balls do not decay and release the lepton number into the universe until after the electroweak phase transition. Okay, So they were the production mechanisms, and now the constraints. The first set of constraints on the asymmetries comes from CNBR. The total, the contribution from one neutrino species to the total energy and radiation in the universe increases with the neutrino's degeneracy. This extra energy density, tends to this extra energy density in radiation, tends to delay the epoch of matter radiation equality. So from an observational point of view, it would amplify the first acoustic peak in the CMBR anisotropy spectrum and shift all the peaks to higher multipoles. Not so recent analysis of the CMBR data puts a constraint of 3 on the degeneracy parameters. Future experiments should be able to push this limit down even further. MAP apparently can be sensitive down to 0.5, and Planck can do 0.25. Second set of constraints comes from standard BBN. The beta processes are of primary importance for nucleosynthesis because it determines the neutron to proton ratio. If there's an asymmetry, if there's a chemical potential in an electron neutrino sector, it will shift the equilibrium of these processes and consequently affect the neutron to proton ratio. The primordial helium mass fraction is particularly sensitive to entropy at freeze out, when these processes freeze out. So in principle, one can use measurements of YP to put constraints on the chemical potential in the electron neutrino sector. Current observations put YP at 0.244 or 0.234, depending on who you speak to. And the constraints that one can obtain from there on the electron neutrino degeneracy parameter is pretty tight.
Is that tighter than the other constraint that you showed before?
Sure, the other one's 3.
It's only on UE.
Sorry?
Right.
Yeah, this one's only on UE. Yeah. The other one, the CMBR one, is on single chemical potential you think of. Okay, that's the second BBN scenario. Recall from a couple of slides ago that a large degeneracy in any flavor tends to raise the total energy density in radiation. This has the effect of increasing the expansion rate of the universe, and therefore raises the freeze-out temperature of the beta processes that I showed you on the previous slide, by virtue of the fact that the expansion rate supersedes the interaction rate at a higher temperature. So as a result, the neutron-proton ratio at freeze-out is increased, and so too is the primordial helium mass fraction. Now, it's actually possible that this increase in the freeze-out temperature due to a large degeneracy in, say, nu mu and nu tau is offset by a sizable and positive degeneracy parameter in the nu e sector, so that this exponential factor here is more or less restored to its normal value. This is known as degenerate BBN, and if this scenario is allowed, these are the constraints that we could put on the degeneracy parameters. And these are, if you remember what I showed on the previous slide, these bounds are a lot. The bound on the new E degeneracy parameter is a lot. It's not quite as tight. The third set of constraints that I'm going to show you, it's not an independent set of constraints. It actually comes from a combined analysis of degenerate BBN and CMBR, and here they are. Now, BBN and CMBR are two completely different events separated in time by several hundred thousand years. So before we can actually treat them on equal footing, we have to, there's some caveats that we have to note. There's several points here, but the basic idea is that between the epochs of BBN and CMBR, the number of relativistic degrees of freedom must not depart from a standard value if we are to treat the two events on equal footing. Okay. There's several other situations in which a large left-hand asymmetries can play an important role. First one is in the context of the set burst mechanism for producing ultra-high energy cosmic rays. This mechanism relies on the resonant annihilation of massive ultra-high-energy neutrinos on the relative neutrino background, and to produce Z bosons, and these Z bosons subsequently decay hadronically, and these secondaries are what we observe as cosmic rays. An early analysis by Gomini and Kuzenko found that if the neutrino has a mass of 0.07 eV, this is a super K-inspired mass, and if the relative neutrino background has a degeneracy of 4.6, this mechanism can be used to explain events above the GCK cutoff. Now, if you remember the constraints I showed you on the previous page, 4.6 is a little bit too large to be consistent with data consistent with BBN and CMBR data these days. But it's very plausible that with a different combination of neutrino mass and different neutrino degeneracy, and probably with some neutrino clustering as well, the mechanism will still work.
So you greater than 4.6, does that work or
not? I don't know. No one's done it. See, I don't actually remember exactly what they did in this analysis, but I think they were assuming a uniform background. And
bigger Xi will just have more neutrinos, which produce more photons.
Yes. That's the point. That's the point of the putting in a degeneracy parameter. But this is 4.6 is not allowed anymore. So they probably will need a different mass and put in some neutrino clustering, because clustering is supposed to help, apparently.
The point is the scattering on the neutrino backgrounds is rare if the neutrino background density is low. Mm-hmm. So you can either pump it up by having a strong degeneracy, which, as you say, is probably excluded, or by having the neutrinos cluster. But
yes,
neutrinos that light won't cluster, at least locally.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would need a mass of
EV
or something.
Yeah, you would have to change it. It's not, yeah. The second example is in the context of active sterile neutrino oscillations. As we have all heard, active sterile neutrino oscillations are bad for BBN. However, if there is some asymmetry in the plasma, it would constitute a matter of potential for these oscillations and therefore suppress them before the onset of BBN. Now, this idea is actually an old idea from the 90s, and we're not quite sure if it actually works for realistic 2+2 and 3+1 neutrino models that require to explain the oscillation experiments. So it's currently being re-examined. So I can't say anything about it, really. And lastly, in terms of neutrinos emitted from astrophysical events, objects like GRBs and AGNs, a significantly asymmetric relative neutrino background could modify the oscillation probability for these neutrinos when they propagate to the Earth. This is obviously an important issue for future experiments that aim to detect these neutrinos. Okay, so hopefully I've convinced you that large lepton asymmetries are worth studying. What we'd like to do now is to look at how neutrino oscillations, which is an established fact now, can affect the asymmetries. So to begin with, here is a summary of the present status of oscillations and the experimental data. Maximal mixing for the atmospheric neutrinos and large mixing for the solar neutrinos are both pretty well established now. What we don't know is the LSND signal. Is there anyone on LSND here? Probably not. I hope not. It's the one experiment that hasn't been confirmed yet. And because it hasn't been confirmed, we're going to take the minimalist approach and ignore it. So ignoring LSND, the totality of the atmospheric and solar neutrino data can be explained in terms of a three neutrino scenario. So we have nu mu, nu tau oscillations that could explain atmospheric neutrino data, and newly oscillating into some linear combination of nu mu and nu tau would explain the solo neutrino data.
Okay, the last time I talked to people in this community, people tend to think that the LSMB can be ignored. Is that still the sort of the majority view or minority view? Unanimous?
Depends on what people want to. Depends on. No.
We could have a vote now and see.
Yeah. Most, I'd like to know what the status is.
I think. I shouldn't be saying this. It's very hard to fit all the data. With at least, I mean, I was talking about 2+2 and 3+1 models before. Mm-hmm. Either of these models don't fit the data well at all.
LSMB totally. Right.
Yes. If you want to explain it in terms.
Sir Nicholas would cringe on ruling out his data because you didn't have a model that fitted. I mean, I think contradict me that no one has uncovered any obvious error in LSMB, and so they're waiting for mini boom to either confirm or disprove it.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the last workshop last fall, the cosmology room, Dave, in the conference there, Dave Caldwell actually showed up and still defended LSMB very vigorously.
Yeah, if I may say a few words, I mean, yes, I agree. It remains the case that no one has shown an error with the LSMB experiment. So I think Mini-Boon is a very important experiment, and in a year and a half, we'll know the resolution of that.
Mm-hmm. We won't know the resolution.
Sorry?
We probably won't know the resolution. If they see nothing, we'll know the resolution. If they see something, they'll have to consider the larger basis.
Okay. Well, anyway, we will have some significant new information in that in 8 months' time. And let me just say that part of the reason. The major reason that the 3+1 and 2+2 models don't fit the data well is because Subbakanyo Kande have made a claim that nu mu to nu tau is strongly favored over nu mu to nu sterile. Uh-huh. So a lot of it hangs on that particular section of their analysis. So if there were to be any kind of unaccounted for systematic in that, and nu mu to nu s again became a possibility, then the 2+2 and 3+1 models would move back towards being a good fit to the data, because you would solve
it'll be 2+2 in that case
by nu mu to nu s and solar by nu e to nu tau.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's what's driving the bad fit of 3+1 and 2+2.
Okay.
Yeah. Okie doke. So mm-hmm. Just stress again, we're doing a three active flavors, no sterile neutrinos. Okay. There are several groups that have studied the effects of neutrino oscillations on the asymmetries, and here are some credits, just to keep everyone happy. A very early work by Servich et al., it was already argued that BDN bounds on the asymmetries are not valid in the presence of oscillations. In a more recent work, Lunardini and Smirnov show that the present-day values of the neutrino asymmetries in the three flavors are equal as a consequence of the large mixing that's inferred from the oscillation experiments. This idea was taken up more seriously last year by Dolgov et al., and partly because the neutrino interactions in the primordial plasma are more complicated than once thought. They performed some detailed numerical work and show that all the asymmetries are equilibrated prior to the onset of BBN. And from there, they were able to derive some new bounds, some really stringent bounds on the asymmetries because of the equilibration phenomenon. And these bounds that they obtained, and the bounds they obtained in this analysis are so stringent that they're unlikely to be superseded in the near future. The results of Dolgov et al. Were analytically confirmed in two subsequent works, because they didn't supply an explanation, so we explained it. And the rest of this talk would be based on the works, the results of the last two works. So, the few factors that determine neutrino flavor evolution in the early universe. The first one is that oscillations in the presence of oscillations will be modified. Oscillation parameters will be modified in the presence of coherent forward scattering on the electron and on the electron positron background. And because there are just as many neutrinos as there are electrons, coherent forward scattering on the neutrino on neutrinos themselves as well. The second factor that would affect the evolution is the non-forward scattering. It's non-forward scattering. Non-forward scattering tends to non-forward scattering always change. Non-forward scattering changes the that changes the momentum of a neutrino state would always disrupt the oscillation phase. Inelastic and flavor-sensitive collisions, in particular, could freeze a system or it could relax the flavors. Collisions can also help to refill empty states. So in order to maintain the equilibrium, the neutrino's equilibrium distribution. And a third factor is, of course, the expansion of the universe. The oscillation bit and expansion bit can be easily taken care of in a single particle wave function formalism. The collisions, however, are not so easily incorporated in a consistent manner. So for that purpose, we make use of density matrices. Density matrix for a group of neutrinos with momentum p is defined to be a sum of the bilinears in individual neutrino wave functions normalized to some time-independent factor of your choice. So for example, for two flavor system, the density matrix written out in a flavor basis looks basically like this. The diagonal entries here are the occupation numbers. And the off-diagonal entries are intangible quantities that contain the system's phase information. An equation of motion with a density matrix is pretty simple. The coherent part of it is encoded here in the commutator of the oscillation Hamiltonian, which I'll define later, and the density matrix. The non-forward scattering, the effects of non-forward scattering is encoded in this collision operator, which acts on the density matrix rho. The expansion bit, the expansion of the universe, is incorporated on the left-hand side in the Liouville operator. Now, since momentum and temperature redshift at the same rate, it's more convenient if we make use of a momentum-like variable p on t so as to get rid of the redshift factor, base factor, and express time in terms of temperature. So we can rewrite the left-hand side of this in a much simpler way. The oscillation Hamiltonian has three components. The first one is just the standard vacuum oscillation term with the neutrino masses and mixing. The second term comes from coherent forward scattering on a charged lepton background. It has two components. The first component here comes from a local four-frame coupling. And it has diagonal entries that are proportional to the charged lepton asymmetries, which, are, as I told you before, have to be small and therefore pretty negligible.
Excuse me, I forgot to ask a question early on.
Sure.
Maybe you said it, but I missed it. Everything you say applies to Majorana neutrinos, derived neutrinos?
It doesn't matter. I'm just talking about oscillations.
Everything applies to both.
Yes.
Aren't there some slight differences and subtleties about how they can be like the mass matrix can be diagonalized?
So we're doing oscillations, and oscillations are not sensitive to what kind of neutrinos we have.
But it's the Dirac or Majorana?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay.
You can't tell from oscillations. Okay, what was I? Yep. So we've crossed out that one because it's just too small. The second.
Could you say more about what do you mean that they're small? You mean
small compared to this one.
What, one is small compared to the second term?
Well, this term here is the energy density, and actually it's the average energy multiplied by the number of neutrinos that you have there. This term here is the asymmetry, which is of the order 10 to minus 10.
These are the charged leptons.
These are the charged leptons.
Oh, charge, I'm sorry.
Okay. Yep. So the non-local term, the second one is a non-local term. It comes from propagated effects. It's also a diagonal term, and the diagonal entries are proportional to the energy densities of the charged leptons. Third term here describes the coherent forward scattering of neutrinos on the neutrinos themselves. Like the charged lepton term, it has two components, for one for a local term and a non-local term. The major difference, however, is that this term depends on the neutrino density matrices themselves. So there is a nonlinear term, and it has off-diagonal elements. Here is the neutrino-neutrino self interaction term in more detail. Rho total is the density matrix summed over all the momentum modes. And rho bar total is, of course, for the antineutrinos. The local term dominates if the neutrino asymmetries are of the order 10 and minus 5 or larger. So it's exactly the opposite case for the,
What are some of the processes that you include in the neutrino-neutrino self-interaction? Neutrino-neutrino scattering?
Neutrino-neutrino scattering via the neutral current.
Anything via neutral current?
Yeah.
Neutrino scattering to antineutrinos?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, which, this is the antineutrino, neutrino-antineutrino term.
Okay, so in some cases, neutrino and antineutrino can annihilate as well, right?
Yes, but that's a GF squared term.
So
it's not coherent forward scattering. The neutrino actually disappears altogether.
Oh, okay. So you're only considering coherent.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, thanks.
This term dominates. The local term dominates if the neutrino asymmetry is larger than 10 to minus 5. And he is. The first term blowing up, this is what it looks like. The diagonal terms are just a standard kind of coherent forward scattering term. The off-diagonal terms are interesting ones. And they arise, and they come from diagrams such as this one here, which allows an electron to turn into a different flavor. So in a sense, the beam and a background neutrino can exchange flavors via the neutral current. Now, a three neutrino system is usually a three flavor analysis is actually pretty hard to do. But fortunately for us, the inherent hierarchy in the mass splittings and the nature of the metapotentials actually allow us to consider the three-flavor system in terms of two-flavor subsystems. And the most common parameterization of the MNS matrix, which is this here, is actually just perfect for that purpose. So in the limit theta 1, 3 goes to 0, the three subsystems are nu mu nu tau, which is described by the atmospheric oscillation parameters. The second subsystem is nu e oscillating into some maximal linear combination of nu mu and nu tau. The mixing angle for that is theta 1, 3. The delta m squared is just the atmospheric delta m squared. And the last subsystem is nu e oscillating into the other maximal linear maximal combination of nu mu and nu tau. And this mode here is described by solar neutrino parameters, solar neutrino oscillation parameters. If theta 1, 3 is exactly 0, this mode here is suppressed. But if we allow theta 1, 3 to be at this upper bound, this mode can actually be important, but I'm not going to talk about it here. Refer to the original works. And the two-flavor limit, it's convenient, it's common and convenient to reparametrize the density matrix and the Hamiltonian in terms of two vector quantities, P and V, such that we can rewrite the equation of motion like so. If we ignore for now the collision operators into these things and consider only the coherent part of the evolution, then we can see that the oscillation phenomenon is exactly analogous to a spin vector precessing about some external magnetic field. Here's a picture showing that. Vector V and spin vector P going around it. Here's the equation of motion. I have rewritten here the external field in terms of this unit vector, which makes an angle 2 theta effective with a set axis. The magnitude of the V vector, which is this stuff out here, would give you the precession rate. The projection of the P vector onto the set axis gives you the excess of one flavor over the other. And it's important to, and in general, it's important to realize that the precession rate and the effective mixing angle are different for different neutrino momenta.
So this is just a nice way of visualizing.
It's a very,
you don't gain anything, right? I don't have to learn this formula.
You don't have to learn this formula, but it's so nice to visualize it. Because if you just write a commutator, it's kind of hard to extract any physical insight, mm-hmm. which is why we're going to this picture.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's just hard, it's just easier to do, look at things this way. Yeah, two more pictures. This shows the resonance or maximal mixing configuration, where the external field vector, the magnetic field vector, is aligned with the x-axis and makes an angle, right angle with the z-axis.
So the mixing angle fixes this direction of V.
Yep.
But how does it fix it in three-dimensional space? There's only one mixing angle?
There's only one mixing angle. What do you mean?
You're given a theta. How do you decide a direction of the green?
Oh.
The formula for the green arrow. That is the
definition of it.
The definition, okay. Yeah. Oh, okay. So one component is always zero.
Well, I mean, if you have some imaginary component in a Hamiltonian, you can have a non-zero y component, mm-hmm. but we're not considering that.
Okay. So that answered my question.
Yeah.
It's always in a point.
Yeah. Okay. And here's the pictorial representation of the MSW effect. Your the external field vector is initially aligned in a set direction, and your P precesses about it.
All these vectors keep changing the density.
Yes.
So this is an instantaneous picture.
Yes. And so when the V vector changes with time or density or whatever, it moves and it moves down to its resonance position. If it moves slowly enough, the P vector will be dragged along as well. Of course, it is not true if it moves really fast. In that case, you have non-adiabatic effects. But adiabatic case, this is what you have.
What happens when there's a collision?
When there's a collision, it depends on what kind of collisions you're talking about. There are two kinds of collisions. Flavor sensitive, a damping kind of collisions usually shorten the P vector in the X and Y direction. So it sort of, you know, P vector, if you just talk about oscillations, the length of it doesn't shrink. But if you have oscillations, it shrinks.
The collisions.
Yes? Yeah. Sorry.
The non-forward effects are sort of lost.
Sorry?
The non-forward neutrinos mm-hmm. are sort of lost in the shuffle.
Okay. I'm not talking about the non-forward stuff. Yeah, it's a high-order term that I've decided to leave for now. It's just it becomes hard to do. Okay, and so okay, it goes through the resonance and then it moves to its final configuration, and dragging the p vector along with it, so that the excess in one flavor becomes an excess and the other flavor. Okay, enough basic stuff. Back to business. Back to business of equilibration. First up, I'm going to look at this mode of nu e oscillating into some maximal linear combination of nu mu and nu tau, described by the solar oscillation parameters. This oscillation mode is going to give us eventually equilibration of the asymmetry in nu e and the asymmetry in nu x, which when nu x is this nu mu nu bar plus nu tau, nu mu plus nu tau. In the equations of motion for the neutrinos and the antineutrinos, there is this term which is responsible for vacuum masses and mixing. The electron and positron background term, and this term here is for the neutrino self-interaction. The vector I, which is the sum of p minus p bar, is sort of like a total angular momentum term, and it supplies an internal magnetic field for the vector p, such that, what have I done? Such that the self-interaction term I cross P is sort of like a spin-spin coupling. Self-interaction term dominates if the initial asymmetries, if the difference between the initial asymmetries is larger than about 10 to the minus 5. So from that, we saw in that case, the zeroth order solution to the evolution equations says that P and P bar are always pinned to I, always pinned to the angular momentum, the total angular momentum. So, and because it's pinned to it, it follows where, because P and P bar are pinned to I, they follow wherever I goes. So in order to track the evolution of P and P bar, we first have to track the evolution of I, the total angular momentum vector. Here's the equation of motion for I, which is constructed basically from the sum of p minus p bar, I mean dp bar dt, whatever. And the end result is actually surprisingly simple. Apart from this extra factor out the front, this equation of motion for the total angular momentum vector looks exactly like the equation of motion for a single mode, for a single spin vector p. It has a term for the masses and mixing. It has a term for the electron positron background, but it doesn't contain a term for the neutrino-neutrino interaction. It has completely disappeared. And the momentum y is replaced with some mean momentum y tilde, which is roughly equal to pi. So what this equation of motion means is that you have an effective external magnetic field V, which points in a direction defined by the stuff in the brackets, and your total angular momentum I precesses around it. And because of the strong spin-spin coupling between the total angular momentum and the spin vectors P and P bar, and because P is always pinned to I, the P and P bar would effectively oscillate, precess around the effective external magnetic field as well. So what we have therefore is an apparent synchronization of all the neutrinos, all the neutrino and anti-neutrino momentum modes. So if we track the evolution of the neutrino ensemble, we'll find that at temperatures above 3 MeV, the mixing is suppressed by the electron positron background. As the temperature decreases, the external field vector also changes, such that at temperatures below 3 MeV, vacuum oscillations would take over. And your V vector would move to this new configuration, which is almost parallel to the x-axis because of a large mixing angle that we have in there. And if it's adiabatic enough, the total angular momentum vector would be dragged along with it, and so too would the individual spin vectors P and P bar.
3 MeV is about when the mu and tau neutrinos begin decoupling. Is that an accident, or is that?
No, actually, no. This 3 degrees here actually is actually determined by the strength of the strength of the coherent force scattering on the neutrino background, on the electron, sorry, charged lepton background, and the delta m square of the neutrino oscillations.
So yet another coincidence.
Yeah.
Well, the decoupling depends on g squared, right?
Mm-hmm.
So since g squared isn't in here, it must be coincidental.
Yeah. Okay. So this is actually, I mean, it looks fairly simple, but it's actually a surprising result because although we have these extremely large neutrino asymmetries in there, they don't actually suppress the oscillations and delay the transition from here to the vacuum configuration. This is totally contrary to what we expect because, you know, this is totally contrary to the case of active sterile neutrino oscillations, where a large L would always suppress the oscillations. And because of and what's more surprising is that these large asymmetries have also removed any nonlinearity in the system, and the system becomes so predictable that we can actually write down an expression for the final asymmetry in terms of the initial asymmetries and the vacuum mixing angle, which we know. So equilibration between asymmetry means equilibration between asymmetries means that this term here evaluates to zero, and this is, you know, obviously always true if the mixing angle is really large, so that cos 2 theta is almost zero. So the fact that we have equilibration before BBN is really entirely a consequence of the large mixing angle solution of the solar neutrino problem. How much time do I have? I don't have much time, so I'll skip this. I'll just say a couple words. We've neglected the collision so far because it's really difficult to do. It's not, there are all kinds of, they're flavor sensitive as well as flavor blind scattering, and you know, it's just too bad. We don't really know how to do it. We're still working on it. But from general considerations, putting in flavor-sensitive collisions would tend to relax the flavors, and usually, and you get you should get a factor of like this, an exponential damping factor in this expression, and this just basically means that the equilibration will be even more complete. I don't have time, do I? No, I won't go through that.
You don't
okay.
have a very good
plan
of time.
No, well, anyway. The other functional mode is nu mu nu tau. This proceeds at with the oscillation parameters of the atmospheric neutrino data box, whatever. And this is supposed to give us equilibration of the asymmetries in a new mu and a new tau sector. The equilibration of these two asymmetries is similar to the previous case, except that now we have to we have to replace the electron positron background with a muon anti-muon background coming from a small number of non-relativistic muon and muons and anti-muons in the back, in the plasma. The transition from vacuum oscillation from matter suppressed oscillations to vacuum oscillations takes place at about T equals 12 MeV, and because this mode is maximally mixed, we expect full equilibration. Although I haven't really been treating collisions, I can tell you that because there are more collisions at a higher temperature, collisions are more frequent at higher temperature. You know, it would help the equilibration, help with the equilibration. So here's a summary of everything I've said. At 12 MeV, you have nu mu tau, it becomes the nu mu, the mu plus mu minus mu plus background. That gives you correlation of the asymmetries in nu mu and nu tau. 3 MeV, you have this other process, and this is supposed to give you asymmetry, equilibration of the three asymmetries. An important thing to note is that all these happen before the onset of BBN, which means that whatever bound you have on the asymmetry on the neutrino, on the electron neutrino degeneracy parameter, would apply to all the flavors. So this is a list of the new limits. Because the chemical potentials of the three neutrino species are the same, it means that degenerate BBN is no longer possible unless there is some new physics that we don't know about. So in that case, the new bounds on the degeneracy parameters for the three flavors are simply the one that is imposed on the electron neutrino sector by standard BBN, and that's 0.07. Now, it is still possible that there is some non-standard contribution to the total energy density of the total energy density in radiation in the universe, so as to accelerate the expansion rate and offset the shift in the beta equilibrium due to a degeneracy in the electron neutrino sector. If that's the case, it's sort of like we have a non-standard degenerate BBN scenario going on, and the bounds on the asymmetries on the degeneracies would be 0.2. But either way, it's a significant improvement over what we had previously. And I've just noted here that Planck, which is the best thing we have, probably the best thing we're going to have, it's only going to measure the degeneracy down to about 0.25.
Planck measures it by measuring the expansion rate, or the relativistic energy density, right? But if you have new physics, that changes the...
Yeah, actually, rate. I know, I was hoping I could get away with not explaining it, but yeah. Okay, so summary conclusions. Large Laplan numbers and a small baryon number are theoretically possible, so don't rule them out. Don't rule out large Laplan numbers. Having a large Laplan number can affect BBN and CNBR, it definitely affect them, and can possibly do something for ultra-high energy cosmic rays. It could kill or save the sterile neutrino, we don't know yet, but we're looking at it, and it would certainly affect neutrinos coming from the neutrino oscillation probabilities for neutrinos coming from GRBs and AGNs. Flavor oscillations can change the BBN and CNBR limits on L, neutrino evolution in the primordial universe, in the primordial plasma, in the presence of large asymmetries, experience non-linearity. So as a consequence, the asymmetries are equilibrated prior to the onset of BBN, and because of that, you can work out some stringent bounds on all the flavors, and these new bounds are unlikely to be surpassed by anything in the near future. So, thank you very much. Can I switch this off? Yep.